This is good. Yeah. Saying to do good, avoid evil, and the general baseline is that so long you don't harm others, you are good to go. But isn't it very hard not to harm any party, especially when making big decisions? Okay, so is it possible to actually not harm anyone when we make decisions? It depends. You know, I guess I'm not sure exactly what you have in mind here, but when you say making big decisions, exactly what you mean by that. Maybe you're talking about business decisions, perhaps somebody will be harmed, like if you make a decision, maybe a competitor will not do so well, this kind of thing. I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about here, but generally speaking, you just have to look into your heart, right, and to ask yourself, where are you coming from? Why are you doing this? What is driving your decision? That's really kind of the most important thing of all. Where are you coming from? And if you're coming from a good place, then basically you're doing the right thing. And you're right, sometimes maybe you cannot avoid hurting others. Sometimes it also depends on what you mean by hurting. You know, sometimes people might be temporarily perhaps hurt a little bit, but in the long run it might be for the good. Similarly in the suttas, where the Buddha talks about this, and he says that sometimes it's like a child. If a child gets something stuck in their throat, right? Even if it's choking on something, so even if you have to stick your finger into the throat and pull it out, and maybe that will hurt the child, maybe it will cause it to bleed even. You do that because you want to save the child from choking to death or whatever. So sometimes hurting people temporarily is fine. It really depends exactly on what you mean by that question. But look into yourself. Ask yourself where you're coming from. Are you trying to do the right thing? Are you trying to do the good thing? And if you are, that is really what matters. You cannot guarantee that it will be good for everyone, but as long as your motivation is good, that is the important issue. Yeah, if you're not happy with that answer, maybe come back later on and explain in a bit more detail what exactly you have in mind, because it's not entirely clear to me now. Okay, so here we go. Next one. Story of the Australian man being afraid of rebirth. What is the negative aspect since he achieves... his status through hard work? The negative aspect is just that you realize that as long as your hard work is your choice, as long as you have the feeling that you are doing this hard work because you are choosing to do it, it is your choice, coming from free will, then it feels meaningful because you're fulfilling your own free intentions. But if you realize that actually it's not you doing it at all, you're being pushed around by some kind of impersonal force. And this impersonal force is the force of the karma from a past life. is the program that has already been written in past lives. And you're just being pushed around by that. You're not doing this out of free will anymore. You're doing it because it's a compulsion. You're compelled to do this. And that's when it becomes scary, because you realize that instead of actually being something positive in your life, you are being trapped by this. You will do this also in your next life, right? We start from scratch, build it up. And the life after that, start from scratch, build it up. And then you die. Start from scratch, build it up. Then you die. Start from scratch, build it up. Then you die. After a while, you just head up with that, right? Head enough. You don't want to do that anymore. So this is the problem here, is that you're just doing the same thing over and over and over now. And you're not actually getting anywhere. So the craving is always there, and the craving is never really satisfied, and you keep on doing the same thing again and again and again, running on the same program. And that is what is so scary about that. It is just, just as I was saying yesterday, you may, in this life, you may feel like everything is very, things are important, right? You go through the same stages, you go through the childhood, then you get education. Yeah, I get educated, right? This is really nice. And then you get perhaps married, and you have a married life, and your work is important to you, bringing up your family in a good way is important to you. But all of these things, even though they seem important in this life, once you see that you have done this 100 times before, 1,000 times before, right? 1,000,000 times before, then it kind of changes the perspective, and it changes the calculation, and it doesn't seem so interesting anymore. If you have gone through the, growing up with your parents, getting an education, and each time it seems very important, but that's only because you lack the perspective of the big picture. Once you lack the perspective of the big picture, you see that you suddenly realize you're not actually going anywhere. I think the reason why we think it is important in this life is because we have this feeling that we're actually going somewhere. We're reaching some kind of goal. But when you realize that you've actually done it 1,000,000 times before, you realize there is no goal. Just going around and around and around, doing it again and again. And then all of that loses its kind of meaning for you, right? It becomes meaningless. And this is exactly the same thing with this person. He realized that actually he wasn't going anywhere. He was going around on a treadmill and basically going through the same kind of suffering, the same kind of problems, life after life. So he achieving his status, he isn't really achieving his status, because then he loses his status, then he has to regain it, and he loses it and has to regain it, right? This is what it is. What it means to be on a treadmill just going around and around. You're not actually achieving anything. You're starting from scratch and going, doing things again and again. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. If I have thoughts of breaking the five precepts but no action taken, are there coming consequences for just having such thoughts? I think that such thoughts can arise very easily, right? The thought themselves is very, there's not much karma in just the thought or just an intention. The real problem is actually in the action or the speech or whatever we do. So the thinking itself is not such a big issue. But of course, very often what happens is that if you under the right circumstances or the wrong circumstances, whatever you want to look at it, these thoughts can actually become very powerful, and they can end up being acted out. And this can be the problem. So ideally, we want to overcome the bad thoughts as well, right? This is kind of the ideal. Because eventually, those thoughts are going to turn into reality. You're going to end up doing those bad things. And I remember there was a survey that I read from a university in the United States, and these were the students at this university, maybe they were about 20 years old or something, and they were asked the question, have they had any murderous thoughts over the past year? And I think something like 95% of the students said they've had murderous thoughts over the past year, right? So you can see how basically we are all pretty much potential murderers. Right? So And we obviously, we have probably murdered people in the past life, and if we don't deal with the things because the thought, the underlying tendency is there, we're going to do so again in the future. So if you don't want to be a murderer, you've got to deal with the underlying thinking mind, the underlying problem. And that, of course, is something that is a very important part of the path, is actually dealing with the underlying problem, with the ill will, with the delusions. And I will, I'm going to talk more about that later on, how to deal with that. It's a very important part of this. Because that is where you purify yourself in a very deep way. Keeping the five precepts is great, but actually thinking, changing your entire outlook, the way you think about the world, right? That is a much deeper kind of purification, whereby your whole character basically is being changed. So many questions today, so I'll go a little bit faster than yesterday. During group meditation, I can sometimes feel the presence of well-practiced meditators in my presence, e.g. as I'm conducting the session. Is it my imagination? It is like an energy radiating out from this person that I can feel. Is it your imagination? Perhaps it is. It doesn't really matter, right? The most important thing is that when you sit in a group, very often it can be helpful. Whether it's your imagination or not is not really so important. What matters is that you're part of a group, and that group feeling, right? Especially when, maybe one of the reasons why you feel that is because if you're a monk, you have a little bit more authority. So then you think, oh, okay, this is great to be here when somebody like a monk is here. But don't worry too much about whether it is an imagination or not. What matters, just enjoy the feeling here. Right? If the feeling is good, that is what is the most important thing. Just enjoy that. I've been surprised sometimes I have been leading meditation, and sometimes my own meditation hasn't been very good. And somebody in the audience said, wow, that was so great, right? What a wonderful meditation that was. All the time it's the other way around. So it doesn't really matter. It is the feeling that you get into. And that is what is the most important thing here. So enjoy that feeling here. And one of the things I often advise people to do is that sometimes when you meditate on yourself, it can be quite hard to get into that feeling. Things are going, it can be hard to get into the kind of mood, right, of meditation. And very often, one of the good things to do is to have a recording of a guided meditation of somebody you like. And then play that while you're doing it, because it helps you to get into the mood. Otherwise, you sit there in your kind of apartment in Singapore, right? You just hear the traffic outside. It doesn't really work very well, right? And then afterwards, think, yeah, okay, whatever. And then, so sometimes just having that is quite nice. And then that might help. We'll put on some chanting, some kind of background which kind of drowns out any noise which isn't the right for the meditation practice. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that the Buddha practiced asceticism similar to the Jains. I wonder what the Jains' reaction was after seeing that asceticism did not work in the Buddha's path towards enlightenment. Thank you. Well, I think it doesn't actually say in the sutta that he did it in the presence of the Jains. All it says is that he practiced certain very harsh ascetic practices, almost to the point where he died. And it is very similar to the way the Jains practice asceticism. It doesn't actually say that he was, was in the presence of Jain ascetics or anything like that. But remember, in the early days, the Buddha was just one spiritual seeker among many spiritual seekers. And although he would probably have been very impressive in some ways, he wasn't the Buddha yet, he was just the Buddha to be. Although he was very impressive probably in many ways, he wasn't anything kind of really out of the ordinary yet. And because of that, if the Jains saw him and they kind of failed, it may not have had that much impact on them. They would just have continued their own practice. A lot of the reason why people practiced asceticism in those days was because that was expected of a monastic. If you were a samana, it was expected that you should practice asceticism. So society would look, if you stop doing asceticism, society would say, what? You have given up the ascetic vow. You have given up becoming enlightened, right? You're not practicing asceticism anymore. What are you doing? You dodgy character here. Right? That's what society would tell you. And this is why it was also very hard for the Buddha to give up the asceticism. When he then later on came back to the five monks, right? He was surrounded by the five monks, and they were really the people who were with him. Maybe they were Jain, that's an interesting point, I'm not sure. And then later on, when he came back, he said, well, I found the middle way. They sort of said, well, you've given up the path, right? How can you have found the middle way? How can you have found awakening when you have given up the path of practice? That was considered the right way of practice by society. So a lot of pressure to do that, right? A lot of pressure to follow that path. And to give it up takes a lot of confidence to step out of what most of society thinks you should be doing. It takes confidence in the sense that you dare to challenge what everybody else is doing. It's always difficult to do, to step out of the mainstream and just go your own way. It takes a strong character to do that. And of course, that's exactly what the Buddha had. Okay, thank you for very good Dhamma discourses. Question number one. What is your definition of practice? I've noticed some monks' practice is so egotistical that it is uninspiring. Comment, please. So what is the definition of practice? Well, practice is just following the Noble Eightfold Path, right? That is the practice. And, the idea that the path that you can get anywhere if you are egotistical, it's impossible to actually get anywhere if you are egotistical. Because if you are egotistical, you're not really fulfilling the definitions of metta, of kindness to others. You don't have a broad mind, you have a very narrow mind focusing on yourself. And you cannot really go down practice the path fully with being too concerned just about yourself. It just doesn't work. But be careful. Sometimes it can be very hard to really know whether somebody is egotistical or not. What things look like externally may not be what actually things are going on internally. Some people may be just practicing in a cave somewhere, doing their own thing. It's not necessarily egotistical to do that, as long as you're making progress, as long as you're heading in the right direction. So it depends, it varies a lot. Ajahn Brahm was on retreat for 6 months, just doing his own practice. And I can assure you, he wasn't egotistical in that sense of having a narrow mind, right? He was very, even then, he would have been, had a very open heart in a sense. And his heart would have been full of kindness and giving in a sense, even though he wasn't actively pursuing that. And it actually says in the suttas that if you don't have this open-heartedness, the heart that wants to give, the heart that always wants to share with others. If you haven't got that, you cannot attain samadhi, right? Samadhi depends on having this sense of generosity inside of you. And this is one of the good reasons to practice generosity, because you're learning more about the kind of mind state that is required for samadhi practice and deep meditation to work. So egotism, being self-centered, is bound to fail. It cannot actually, it's impossible to have this on the path. And this is why very often this kind of distinction we have between Hinayana and Mahayana is actually a false distinction. Because in all Buddhist practice, you have to be absolutely self-sacrificing in a very true sense to be able for the path to actually work at all. Okay, Mickey Mouse retreats can be more conducive for better meditation as our minds are more happy than when staying in dirty retreat centers. Okay. Parents can attend as children can attend too. Yes, that's a very good point. I didn't really mean, when I said Mickey Mouse retreat, I didn't mean that in a derogatory sense at all. I just meant that it is it's less strict than ordinary retreats. I call it Mickey Mouse. Actually, it's good, right? We have different types of retreats for different situations. We have different things, as you say here. The kids can come as well, but it's great, right? It makes it more accessible for everyone. It's just that there are different types of retreat for different occasions. Now with the Christmas season, you go out and you do a few Christmassy things, you combine that with a spiritual practice, a bit of meditation, it's actually quite good, right? It's not bad at all. And then at other times you may go on a more strict retreat. It's all about finding the right thing at the right time. So it is quite, you're quite right. Sometimes these things can be quite useful. And sometimes some people get better meditation here than they might get if they have gone to a strict, as you say, and perhaps dirty retreat center. I hope you're not referring to Jhana Grove. If you are, then you please let me know so I can bring the news back to Jhana Grove and sort out the management. Okay, so next one. Dear Ajahn, I read that Kamma, that is not bright and not dark, is the Noble Eightfold Path. Why? Surely practice the Noble Eightfold Path is all bright. Okay, so the idea here is that the Kamma that is bright, it has bright results, right? So it means that in the future you will receive happy results as a consequence. And happy results here basically means like, you know, rebirth in a good existence where you can experience all kind of happy things as a consequence. Now the idea of the neither dark nor bright results is results which don't lead to rebirth at all. And that's why it is called this. And that's why when you practice the Noble Eightfold Path in the right way, it actually leads to that outcome, neither dark nor bright. And for that reason, that's what it's called. You are right, in one way it is bright. In a sense, it's kind of the highest kind of brightness, right? Because it leads to the end of all suffering, all problems. But on the other hand, because there is no rebirth at all, that is why it's neither cold, neither dark, nor bright in this situation. But for most of us, remember that we're not really practicing the Noble Eightfold Path because we don't really know what it is, right? You haven't seen it yet for yourself. It's only the Aryans, the stream emperors, and all the other arahants or whatever who actually know what the Noble Eightfold Path is. We are approximating to the Noble Eightfold Path. We're doing our best. But we've not actually hit the Noble Eightfold Path 100%, because we have absolutely pure intentions. We don't really fully understand what Nibbana is, so we cannot have the intention to go towards Nibbana. We just have a general idea that we're heading in the right direction. So actually making this kind of Kamma is very difficult. And the only person, as far as I'm concerned, who can make this kind of Kamma, which is neither dark nor bright, is actually the Aryans, because they understand what is going on. Okay, question number two. Sankhara is the cause for consciousness. If I define consciousness as the six consciousnesses, eye, ear, smell, etc., then how does it work? How does Sankhara cause the consciousness, or am I wrong? Confused. Thank you. Okay, so the idea here is that when you do many, lot of good acts, right? It's like your mind is raised, is kind of raised up. And that mind is the consciousness having changed. So that this affects all your consciousness, whether it is the eye or whether it is the ear or whatever, all your consciousness is elevated as a consequence of that. So when you see things, right, you see things differently. When I, you know, if I'm in a bad mood and I see one of you, I think, oh, terrible person or whatever, right, I'm in a bad mood. But if I'm in a good mood, I think, wow, what a wonderful thing it is to see all these good friends in the Dhamma. And it's like that. Your consciousness has been affected by your sankharas. So what you see things in a different way. You hear things in a different way. You think about things in a different way. Everything changes as a consequence of the sankharas. So your mind is lifted up. This becomes especially powerful when you get reborn, because when you get reborn, you enter an entire different sphere, a different reality. And that is when you really understand that your consciousness has changed. Because then what you see is completely different, right? If you get reborn in a very high realm, everything you see will be much more beautiful. Everything you hear will be much more beautiful. Your consciousness has changed. What you experience changes. These are called in the Pali the stations of consciousness. Consciousness is stationed in a higher place. And because it is stationed in a higher place, the experiences you have are different. The experiences here are nama-rupa, right? Vijnana, pratyaya, nama-rupa. Nama-rupa are all the experiences that you have. So consciousness and experience go together like that. So this is how it works. It's not that sankhara create consciousness, but it decides, if you like, the level of consciousness. And it also sustains consciousness, so it continues into the future. Yeah? Okay. What is a silent retreat? What are the rules to observe? Okay, for somebody who wants to go further. Okay, so that is that's good. So a silent retreat is usually what you have when you go to a retreat center, like you come to Jhana Grove or most retreat centers around the world, they will usually it will be a silent retreat. So it means that you try to avoid speaking to people, and it's very beautiful when you do that, because a lot of the business that goes on in our mind, a lot of the thinking is created by the contact we have with people around us. So if you don't talk very much, after a while, your thinking mind also starts to die down. It's not always true. Some people just think for 9 days, right, without end. And that is fine. If that's what happens to you, of course, there's nothing much you can do about that. But if you, for many people, for some people at least, when you become silent, it tends to die down. The important thing here is to be silent in the right way. For some people, being silent for nine days is pure torture, because they need to communicate, they need to talk, they can't deal with it, right? So it's the attitude that you have to silent that is so important. So when you go on retreat, you have to think, wow, this is really nice to be silent. And when you get into that kind of sense of it being beautiful and nice, that is when it has real benefits. And that's why it's called noble silence, because it brings out the noble qualities in you when you're doing it in the right way. But it has to be the right way. And this is why it is so important. We shouldn't force ourselves to do these things. It should come quite naturally. When it comes naturally, that's when it becomes powerful. There are people who go on retreats and who try to meditate and find meditation terrible. Right? And one of the reasons for that is because they have all kinds of issues inside of themselves, maybe things from the past that they don't want to deal with or whatever. So as soon as they become quiet, all these things start happening in their mind, and they find it pure torture. Even just to sit quietly, closing their eyes, they find it very, very difficult. So if you find that meditation actually is quite hard, please don't force yourself. Please don't make this into some kind of torture that is very difficult for you to bear. If that is what is happening, then do other things instead. Remember, the Buddhist path is very wide. There are many things in Buddhism that are much more important, actually, than meditation practice. The basic things like the qualities of your heart, how you treat other people, how you act, how you speak, right? These are the things that are the most foundational and the most important things. So meditation is not kind of the end-all and be-all of Buddhism at all. Meditation is actually something that comes from those foundation stones when you live your life well in the first place. So if you can't really meditate, that's fine. You are just one among a large number of people who find meditation difficult. There's nothing wrong with that. Anyway, so we talk about rebirth. What is reincarnation? Is the mind transferred? Thank you. Okay, so rebirth and reincarnation is basically the same thing, right? These are just words, and some people use them differently. Some people say, oh, the right word is rebirth. No, reincarnation is the right word, right? And they're just words. It's just the important thing is how we understand these things. And of course, one of the most important things from a Buddhist point of view is that you don't see that there is anything essential, any essence, the real you, which gets transferred. This is kind of the Buddhist view. In other religions, they will say reincarnation means that the soul or the essential self goes from one life to another one. That is not the Buddhist view. No. The Buddhist view is just a process that continues after you die. Just like you have a process in this life, that process continues after you pass away. Yeah. Is the mind transferred? Well, the mind is like, in a sense, always there, right? The mind is here right now. So what happens when you die is that the body falls away. And then when the body falls away, your mind, you're still here, right? And then you kind of, what you start, if you have made a lot of good karma, you start experiencing another reality after you die. And that reality can be very beautiful then. Is the mind transferred? It's more like just a change in experience. Your experience changes. It's not like you're going somewhere, right? You're moving on to a new realm, like taking the plane from Singapore to Bangkok. It's not like that, right? You don't have to get on board any plane. It's more like, just, okay, now the experience is different. And that is what kind of how it works. Because you have developed a more pure state of mind. The mind is what kind of is the essence of who we are. So that doesn't really get transferred. It's the experience that gets transferred. Even when you go on the plane from Singapore to Bangkok, right? What is actually going on? Well, what is going on is that you are just there, and then the surroundings around you are changing. Different experiences, right? Are you actually going anywhere? Are you? Well, in one way you are, but in one way you're also just staying put. And experience is just changing around you. That's another way of looking at the transfer from Singapore to Bangkok or from Perth to Bangkok or whatever. Experience is just changing. And you're just aware of the nature of change around you. That's all you do. Right?
This is
Ronnie. Yeah.
If every day like the rebirth, because if you compare today at our age, our mind is very different from when we were 8 years old.
Yeah.
So
is that rebirth? Yeah. It's change, right? I think that the point is that some people, that's one argument that people often use, right, is the idea that every moment to moment you get reborn in a sense. But we have to be careful here with how we use language. I mean, that is, in one way, it is an acceptable way of looking at things, because things are always changing. So things are always changing means that, in a sense, you are kind of you know, you're always emerging as a new person, so to speak. Yeah. But the point is that when you die, there is a big change, right? And this is kind of the point here. You're kind of that's when you can move from one level to another one, and you can experience a massive change in your experience. And this is what really is the meaning of rebirth, that enormous change of experience that can happen when you get reborn. During life, it is much more gradual, right? It's more like, okay, yes, you're not the same person now you were 10 years ago, but there's also a clear sense of continuity as you go along. Then you die, and suddenly, bang, you may go up, or you may go down, or you may continue. But that is when, that's what we mean by the ripening of karma, because you may have developed your mind throughout your life.
So if you had some very major change in your life, like you became a paraplegic,
yeah.
Or if you suddenly, won $20 million,
yeah.
You know, that just completely,
yeah.
Isn't that a huge change in your life that your mind has to suddenly adjust?
Yeah, it is. It is a huge change. I don't think you would call it rebirth, though.
Drastic change.
It can be. But one of the interesting things about that is that, you know, very often people become paraplegic or whatever, and they go through kind of a really tough period when it's really, really hard to accept straight away. And after a while, they come to terms with it. And what happens is that the mind kind of gradually comes up, and it comes back pretty much to the level that you were before. And as people say, is that, of course, every time you consider, oh, I'm paraplegic, that's when you suffer. But most of the time you don't think about it. You just do other stuff. You're reading a book, or you're maybe enjoying your meditation practice, and you don't even think about being paraplegic anymore. And of course, when it isn't on your mind, it doesn't bother you either. Yeah. And you know, winning the... I've read some stories about people who won the lotto, like $20 million or $100 million or whatever, right? And a lot of those people are incredibly miserable afterwards. They're really high for a very short period of time, and then their life kind of takes a change for the worse because they don't know how to deal with that kind of money. It just comes too fast, and they use it in stupid ways, and it kind of end up everything being terrible. There was a story about, this was from the UK, and there was this family, very ordinary British family, living in a very small house somewhere in, I don't know, North London or something like that. And suddenly they won this massive prize, £10 million or something like that. So they decided, okay, we're going to buy a mansion somewhere. They buy this enormous mansion in the countryside, right? And then after a year, after a few months, they move back into their old house again. And people ask them, well, what happened? And they say, oh, what happened was that when we lived in this little house together, we saw each other all the time. We were around each other. It was so nice. When we moved into this enormous mansion, you know, the father stayed in one wing, the kids were in another wing. We never saw each other. It was just so lonely to live in this enormous mansion. Okay, so we moved back into this small house again. So this is kind of the kind of unforeseen consequences of becoming really wealthy, right? And then your friends start to treat you differently. If all your friends are poor like everybody else, and suddenly you become the one rich person among all the poor ones, your friends start looking at you differently. They expect you to look after them, to do all kinds of things for you. So sometimes these things are much more of a curse than we are willing to accept sometimes. You know, that's why when you earn wealth in a more natural way, you tend to be able also, I think, to deal with it better. And that is kind of one of the things there. So it's important that these words can be used in different ways. But what the point really is that we have to use the words in the way that the Buddha intended them to be used. This is kind of the real issue. What did the Buddha mean by the rebirth? That is what is really interesting, and not what some kind of modern, you know, interpreter thinks it should mean to them. That is, to me, is not so interesting at all. Okay. Ajahn, how long after death does rebirth occur? Does one benefit from transference of merit even after rebirth? Okay, so how long afterwards does it occur? I think it varies tremendously. Depends on how strong your karma is. If you have really strong karma, then bam, you go straight away, right? If you have kind of getting into samadhi, you have the jhanas and things like that, you just close your eyes, you see the nimitta, and bam, you get reborn in that new destination. This is the good thing about having really powerful karma. Or if it is really powerful negative karma, then you can imagine what happens as well, right? You kind of the opposite effect. And sometimes it can take a long time. Sometimes we can kind of hang out in a kind of intermediate state for a long time, a kind of ghostly realm. And I don't think there is any limit to how long you can be in those realms. Does one benefit from the transference of merit even after rebirth? It all depends on what realm you are in. Right? This is one, according to the Buddha, if you are in a certain realm, and this is really the ghost realm, that is the only realm you can really receive the transference of merit. It's not really, it's actually a bad word. It doesn't mean transference of merit. All it means is that you are dedicating the merit to somebody else, and they kind of gain a certain happiness from that. You're not actually transferring anything. If you're transferring it, it means you're losing the merit, right? And somebody else is gaining it. That wouldn't be very good. Okay, take my merit. That's a kind of a... Bodhisattva, or maybe that's, no, I should be careful what I say here. It's a kind of self-negation, right? Okay, I'm going to give up my own life for the sake of others. But of course, the beautiful thing about transference of merit, the way we use this, is that you're actually making more merit for yourself. If you say, oh, may you be happy and well because I have been doing all of these good things, actually you're creating more good karma. There is no such thing as one person losing and another gaining. No, it doesn't work like that. Everybody is gaining it. Right? Win-win situation. Buddhism is all about win-win, not win-lose or lose-lose, but all about win-win. That's what's so beautiful about it. So do always transfer the merit. The Buddha said that if the relative that you want to transfer is not there in the realm that they can receive it, there will always be some relatives in this long period of samsara, some relative from a long way back that will be able to receive your kindness and generosity. Right? So you think about your grandmother or your parents or whatever who passed away, and you wish them well, and maybe they are not there, but somebody else will be able to receive that merit that you're doing it. Yes, please.
You just mentioned that if you're in a ghost realm, you take a longer time for rebirth.
Yes.
That is already rebirth.
Well, this is the thing, is that the ghost realm is kind of ambiguous, right? The question is, where is it that we hang out in the meantime? And sometimes we hang out in the ghost realm. We kind of stay around there for a while. Sometimes it's a proper rebirth, but sometimes it seems just to be a station to somewhere else. It's kind of slightly unclear, right? And if somebody does some transference of merit for you, that can boost your rebirth straight away. Yeah? So it's kind of, it's not entirely clear what is going on in that intermediate state and how long you're staying there for. So the suttas aren't really clear about that. Okay.
Sorry, John. So
yeah.
Basically, perhaps the ghost realm is the same as a hungry ghost realm where you actually reborn there to suffer. But the ghost realm
you're
talking about is the one that seems to be
maybe there is a difference there. None of this is actually explained in detail in the sutta, so it's very hard to actually know exactly what is happening here. I think for many people, yes, it does take some time just for your karma to kind of settle down. One of the things that I think is important here is that very often we talk about being very careful about what to do when you're dying, because when you're dying, well, you have to be very careful, otherwise you get straight to a bad destination afterwards. But the very fact that there is some kind of intermediate existence means that your last thought moment isn't actually that important, because there is some time there for you to kind of settle down afterwards, and your general karma is then what will actually drive you forward into the new life, not so much the last thought moment that you have as you're dying. So what that realm is that you go into afterwards, whether that is part of maybe a subsidiary of the ghost realm, or whether it is a realm in its own right, or whether it just exactly what these things are is not very clear. Because of that, I mean, even the ghost realm can last a very short time if somebody gives you, transfers the merit. So is that a bardo state then, or is it actually a real rebirth? I mean, it's a bit ambiguous. I don't think it matters all that much, actually. It's just names, basically, for different realms. Yeah?
Would it explain why you can see your mom's image within 7 days, or
appearing? Yeah. Sure, but I mean, I think you can see that also with people in the ghost realm, right? Very often, they can actually be accessed quite easily. They can appear quite readily in this realm, so it may be similar to that as well. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Dear Ajahn, when a person is said to be awakened, does it mean that this person has come to the end of the rebirth cycle? That is, yes, that's exactly what it means. So when you are awakened, that's it. No more rebirth in the future. And of course, the whole point about no more rebirth means the end of suffering. That is kind of the important point about it. So the end of rebirth in his own right is, okay, so what, but the point, of course, is that it ends suffering. That's what it really is about. Are you able to see your previous life during meditation? Is that a personal question, or is it just a general question? Yeah, it is possible, right? You can do it, right? So you can do that. So you just have to practice enough, and eventually everyone has the capability of seeing the past life through meditation. So you just have to keep on doing that, and then eventually, when your meditation is profound enough, you can kind of go into the past and kind of check these things out. It's quite interesting, right? I mean, especially if you are a little bit skeptical about rebirth, of course, this is something that you should definitely investigate. Because if it is true, then again, it has tremendous consequences if it is true now. Number three, certain people have long life, live for 90 plus years old, but have poor health. For example, dementia during the last 10 years before they pass away. Is that a combination of good and bad karma in action? The thing about karma, the way karma is explained in the suttas, is that the main aspect of karma is actually about in the kind of realm that you get reborn. Right? So the main thing, are you get reborn as an animal or as a human being, or do you get reborn maybe in a higher realm? That is the main aspect of karma. The things that happen in our life, if you get reborn as a human, there are certain things you can expect, right? Dementia is probably one of those things that you can expect. It is, you know, it's just part and parcel of being a human being. Illnesses every now and again you can expect. Losing your job you can expect. Divorce you can expect. Pain and suffering and problems you can expect. This is what the human realm is like. And sometimes you cannot avoid these kind of things. Yes, it is true that perhaps if you have very good karma, then you will minimize the suffering and the problems in this life, and you will have a slightly better life. But remember, it's only degrees, right? It's often not all that different. Still, you have to deal with suffering. Still, you have to deal with general human problems. Still, you get into a car accident. Still, these problems continue on. Still, you can even die young. If you get reborn as a human, it's possible. One of the consequences of that, you could die young, right? Because that is what happens to some people. I don't think dying young is always the consequence of bad karma. Sometimes it's just the consequence of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. If you have bad karma, definitely you may die young. But even if you haven't, it may still happen to you. Right, this is how you can explain things like the great natural disasters around the world, when suddenly heaps and heaps of people die at the same time. Do all those people have bad karma who are in that place? A whole village gets wiped out. If everyone in that village had bad karma, it sounds kind of weird. It doesn't seem to work like that. Some of them might have had bad karma, but some of them, well, they were just ordinary people who ended up having a short life. So this is the thing, it's pretty uncertain, right? And pretty unlikely, you just don't know what is going on there. Okay. Okay, if what you are doing is good and beneficial to mankind in this life, does it matter if we return to rebirth next time to do the same thing again, or build up on it? No, that's good. You know, if you build on what you have done before and you continue doing these things, that's of course great. That is kind of ideally what happens when you get reborn. But the problem is that sometimes you don't get the chance to build up on what you did before. Right? You think this is kind of one of the problems of the illusion of a sense of self. The illusion of a sense of self means that you feel like you are this person who is acting in a certain way. You are a Buddhist. You have certain ideals. You have a certain way of looking at the world. And because of that, in next life you will continue. But it doesn't work like that. Next life, you maybe come under the wrong influence, the wrong kind of people, right? You get reborn in the wrong country. You get reborn in Malaysia instead of Singapore. It's so close, right? Just across the causeway, right? And then you get reborn as a Muslim, and then it says on the book, for non-Muslims only, you can't even read those Buddhist books anymore. Right? Sometimes it takes such a small little shift, and then you are cut off from the Dhamma, and you're cut off from many of the things that you actually had before. And that makes your life very, very different. Your parents may be different. All kind of things may be different. So if it was as simple as that, then it wouldn't be a problem. So the point is, the conditions are right now. Now is that the conditions are right for practicing. So you make the most out of this life. Instead of thinking, next time I'll just continue. It's not going to be too concerned about this. Now is the opportunity. So when you think like that, you take every opportunity to do what is right and to do what is good. And then you have the most chance of actually moving somewhere and this going somewhere, going as far as you possibly can. One of the nice things that the Buddha does say about rebirth is that if you get reborn in some kind of devaloka, some kind of heavenly realm, and then you hear the devas, they start to recite the Dhamma, right? They start to recite, I don't know, the Anapanasati Sutta or the gradual training, because we're doing the gradual training now. Think, wait a minute, I heard that when I was at this hotel, the Meridian, in Bangkok, I heard this sutta, right? So you go to Devaloka, and then you recognize it, you recognize the Buddha's teachings. And because you recognize it, you can continue the practice. And this is actually one of the benefits of understanding the word of the Buddha, rather than understanding all the idiosyncratic teachings of various ajahns. Every ajahn, every ayah, every nun, every master, every Rinpoche, they have their own way of presenting the Dhamma. But the one standard, the standard way, the Buddha's way, we find in the suttas. And that is what you will recognize when you go to different realms, right? What they will know is the Buddha's teachings. That is one of the benefits of actually recognizing or reading the Buddha's teachings in this very life. You will recognize it also in the future. Right? So this is one of those hidden benefits of the Buddha's teachings. But if all you have done is listen to, you know, some monk X or nun B and saying their own kind of personal teachings, then there is nothing there really for you to recognize when you get reborn in a realm in the future. Right? This is one of the secret reasons for reading the suttas that many people don't take into account. So take that into account as well when you do this. Okay. So let's go on to the. Do you have a few more questions? Let's just see what happens next. Okay. Question number one. Is it the most critical moment near death? Okay, let's talk about that a second ago. That determines our next phase, e.g., the Pure Land. Wow, okay. So you want to go to the Pure Land, okay? In modern times now, one will usually be in sickness, pain, coma, temporary near death. Therefore, the state of mind and mindfulness will not be strong at that moment. So, how? Okay, as I was saying before, I don't think that near-death experience and near-death point is all that is as important as it is sometimes made to be. Some people make a lot out of this idea of what happens close to death, but actually, the suttas themselves don't say much about that. This is found more in the commentaries and later Buddhism, not so much in the word of the Buddha. From the Buddha's point of view, what really matters is how we live our life, our overall conduct, the sum total of what we have done. That is what actually matters. And I think one of the reasons why this idea of what they call death proximate karma, the karma we make close to dying, one of the reasons why it has gained so much prominence is because of the Theravadan idea that you die and you get reborn straight away afterwards. But actually, that Theravadan idea, I think, does not actually match with how the suttas work. The way the suttas talk about things, there seems to be this span in between lives. Just talking about that a second ago. Regardless almost of whether you go to the ghost realm or whatever you call it, regardless of where you're going, there is a span between there. Not quite regardless. Sometimes the karma is very strong, you go straight away, but most of the time you will have this antarabhava, intermediate state between two lives. And because there is that intermediate state, that allows you to kind of look back on your life, reflect on your life, and then that allows the overall karma, the total experience, to ripen rather than what happened close to your death. Right? So this is how your kind of karma becomes something big rather than something very narrow. So don't this
rope keeps falling off, and you keep trying to keep it on there. So, I'm a good Adam Brown disciple, by the way, because Adam Brown's rope also always falls off, right? I'm trying to follow the right way now. And again, the idea of pure land is really a Mahayana idea of the pure land. The suttas of the Buddha don't really talk about the pure land. It talks about happy destinations, happy rebirth, but not really the pure land. The pure land is a Mahayana idea. And the idea is that you go to the pure land and you become a Buddha there. But there is nothing really that in the early Buddhist equivalent to that. And again, also this idea about the state of mind and the mindfulness when you die. Sometimes people make a lot of this, so that the idea is to be mindful when you die. So don't take any drugs, don't take any morphine, no matter how much pain you are in. But again, I don't think that is actually the right way of understanding this. If you are close to death and you have a lot of pain and the problems are very strong, it's good to take medication to keep those pains down. If you don't take any medication, you are likely to have all kinds of bad consequences, right? You might get angry and upset very easily. And that is not a very nice way of dying. You could be very angry and upset and having all kinds of pains. Use the morphine, it's okay. Because the point is, the moment the dying process starts to set in, the moment you are starting to release from the body, the mindfulness will return. So if you have lived a good life, right? Mindfulness does not depend on whether you have been mindful so much the moment before. Mindfulness depends on what kind of life you have lived. If you have lived a good life, you've been a good person, mindfulness will tend to be okay as a consequence. So as soon as you are starting to release from that body, mindfulness will return, right? And because mindfulness will return, then you will kind of head in the right way regardless. And you will be able to recall all the goodness and all of these kind of things. I don't think there's any problem with taking those drugs and all of those kind of things and then move on into a new existence as an afterward. I think that's perfectly okay. We have to be careful. Sometimes we can cause all kind of unnecessary suffering if we kind of grasp the Dhamma slightly in the wrong way. Okay. Why do people complicate things? Okay, that's actually a good question, isn't it? Why does everything tend to get so complicated? Why is the world such a complicated place? Why does the Dhamma sometimes seem so complicated? Why do we not just have the suttas? Why do we have all these commentaries? Why do we have all this other stuff which we kind of get sidetracked by? Why do all of these things happen? And basically, I think the reason why all of this happened, one of the main reasons, is because we are so restless, right? We want to think. Thinking gives us a sense of identity. And as soon as the Buddha passed away, the monks started to think, and the nuns started to think, and the lay people started to think, what did he actually mean by that? Okay, let's write a commentary on this sutta so we can explain what he actually meant by that. And then they would say, the Dhamma is not complete. The Buddha didn't explain everything. There are some holes here. We need to fill in the holes. Okay, so they created the Abhidhamma, which is supposed to be the final word on what Buddhism is all about. But maybe there is a reason why the Buddha left those holes, right? Maybe those holes were irrelevant. Why did the Buddha leave the holes if they had been important? He wouldn't have left them there. So sometimes it's just our restlessness, it's our habit of always thinking that tends to complicate matters. And I agree with you, it's very important to get back to the basics, get back to the foundations. The Buddhist path is actually very simple. It's about having a good heart. It's about being kind, right? Actually, it is simple in theory, but just being kind all the time actually is quite difficult. So if we put all our effort, everything we do, just on being kind, because it is hard enough as it is, then we're going to make really good progress on this path.
And that is really all we have to do. And if you do that, then when you go to a meditation retreat and you sit down peacefully and you close your eyes, wow, your meditation is going to be so powerful as a consequence. Right? So focus on the essential. Focus on the foundations. Focus on the basic things. And then you will make really good progress. Okay. So, okay. Okay, one, after death, when will one immediately, easily 49 days, be rebirthed into different realm or lie dormant for some time? If unfortunately we are not accepted by Pure Land yet, not a Pure Land person. Okay, so, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by Pure Land. Maybe you have some other idea about that, but I think we have talked about that enough already. And then with a kind of slightly sour face, they're not really sure if this is good or not. Anyway, number two, how can we ensure that we could still learn and progress on Dhamma after death? I think it's a very good question. How can we ensure that we actually progress in Dhamma after we die? There's two things that we have to do to really do that. One of those things I mentioned already, when you come into your next life, you want to be able to recognize the Dhamma. And the way that you recognize the Dhamma is to understand the Dhamma to the best of your ability in this life. The more you understand the Buddha's teachings, and I don't mean, again, the idiosyncratic teachings or various teachings, but actually the teaching of the Buddha, the better you understand like what is going on, the more likely it is that you will continue in a future life, because you will recognize it. You will see there's something there, right? It's already embedded in you in a deep way. So this is the first thing here. The second thing, and this is even more important, and that is that you practice to the best of your ability in this life. The more you practice in this life, the further you are along the path, the clearer your mind is, the more chances it is that you will continue in the next life, because your foundation will be very strong in this life. The more powerful your practice also means the deeper your understanding of the Dhamma is bound to be at the same time. And all of this will then aid you in the future as well. So those are the two things. Understand the Dhamma and also practice to the very best of your ability in this life. Those two things coming together gives you that opportunity. Okay, only three more questions, so hang in there for a couple of more minutes. What can help in concentrating during meditation? For example, focus on breathing may not help in achieving deep concentration. Okay, I don't know, maybe you have not been a disciple of Ajahn Brahm for very long, because you use the concentration word. Concentration, right? Ajahn Brahm will probably tell you off if you heard me using that word. So if you listen to some of Ajahn Brahm's talks, he will say concentration is a no-no, because concentration in English usually means that you're using force, right? Concentrating on this exam, you're focusing really hard on the exam right now, or on the work, or whatever it is. And when you're focusing very hard on something, you're using willpower, and that willpower will deplete your energy, and it will have the exact opposite effect of what it's supposed to do. After a while, the mind is going to get restless, you will have no energy left, and you will not be able to focus on whatever you're focusing on. So, the idea in Buddhist meditation is not concentration in the English sense of the word. The idea is to be able to stay with the object. Is a natural thing that happens when your practice is going in the right way. And this is why the idea of happiness is so important, right? And this is why getting some joy and happiness in the meditation is so powerful. Because wherever there is joy, wherever there is happiness, it is easy to direct your mind towards that. Right? Whatever we enjoy in the world, wow, so easy to stay with that. But when we don't enjoy it, that's when you have to use willpower, because it's not natural to hang out with it. And this is why one of the things the Buddha talks the most about in the suttas is how to give rise to that gladness and joy in meditation practice. So, it doesn't matter if you don't get any joy, that's okay. But if you don't get any joy, just try to enjoy what is already here. Just enjoy the peace. Try to have a more superficial engagement, a more superficial kind of happiness of what is going on. That is also okay. But ultimately, you want to move towards actually finding some real happiness in a meditation practice. And then the meditation starts to become much more powerful. So, what can help you? So that is what really helps you, right? And if you're trying to watch the breath and there is no joy there together with the breath, it can be very hard to focus on the breath. After a while, the mind gets bored. You start thinking about all kinds of stuff. Oh, what am I going to have for dinner afterwards? And what am I going to buy? Go shopping afterwards on Sukhumvit Road and that kind of stuff. I don't know what you do. Maybe I'm just being naughty, not actually. I have no idea what you're doing, but you start thinking about all kinds of stuff rather than being with the breath. That is really the trick of meditation practice. Maximum enjoyment. Okay, the last question for tonight. Oh, more pure land. Okay. Okay, what is your view on pure land Buddhism? Okay, and how do we know if the deceased relative has reached the pure land? Okay, pure land Buddhism. Okay, so I'm just going to have a look at this, see what this is. I think is this a question or what is this sitting down here? It is a question. No, maybe it's not. It is a question. Okay, I'll look at that afterwards then. So pure land Buddhism is a type of Buddhism that emerged a long time after the Buddha. Right? This is described in some of the suttas in Mahayana Buddhism called the Sukha Bhakti Viyuha Sutta, something like that. And it is not really the teaching of the Buddha, because it emerged so long after the Buddha. It is basically a philosophical development that happened after the time of the Buddha. That's really what Pure Land Buddhism is about. But so it depends on what you make out of it, right? If you think of the Pure Land just as a happy rebirth, just like we talk about in all kinds of Buddhism, then that's okay. It just means that a happy realm to be reborn in. And of course, if it is a happy realm, there is more purity there. Then that is a nice way of interpreting the idea of pure land. But if you hold on to some of the Mahayana ideas, some of the Mahayana ideas is that you get reborn in the pure land, and you hang out there, and you get taught by all these Buddhas and all these Bodhisattvas around, right? And then you become a Buddha yourself at the end. And that is where it gets a bit more doubtful whether that has anything really to do with what the Buddha himself taught. It's a later philosophical development. And me, one of the things that I have always done in Buddhism is ask myself, well, the real Buddhism is the teaching of the Buddha. The real Buddhism is not the teaching of later philosophers. We don't know who these philosophers are, right? We don't know who actually wrote these things down. Can we trust these things? How do we know about the pure land if the Buddha didn't teach these things? This is part of the problem. And so, I recommend everybody stick to the early teachings, those things that we can know with a fairly high degree of certainty was taught by the Buddha. Stick to that, and then you have the highest chance of getting real Buddhist teachings, rather than a teaching of some kind of later development. And this is not, I don't want to disparage Mahayana Buddhism at all. There's many good things going on in Mahayana Buddhism. The same problems also exist in Theravada. There are lots of later teachings, not only the early ones. So this is a problem that goes across all of Buddhism, that we tend to focus on later things rather than looking at the earlier things. Right? So go back to the early teachings. The teachings I am giving here on this retreat, these are some of the earliest teachings that you can find in all of Buddhism. They exist in the Chinese Buddhism, they exist in the Theravada Pali Buddhism, they exist to some extent also in Tibetan Buddhism. They exist across the board. These are the only teachings you find across the board in all kinds of Buddhism. And this is one way we know that they are the earliest ones, because they exist across the board. The Pure Land Buddhists only exist in Chinese Buddhism. It doesn't exist in Theravada at all, right? It only exists in one school. And because of that, it is not common to all Buddhists. And for that reason, we can know that it didn't really originate with the Buddha himself. So this is what I would. This is how I would look at this. And I think that it's a very kind of... It's a reasonable way of looking at the Buddha's teachings. Go back to what the Buddha said. The Buddha had to be awakened. If the Buddha wasn't awakened, there is no Buddhism. Everybody else we can have doubts about. We cannot really have doubts about the Buddha. So his teachings are the most certain ones. Okay. Now we have one more question from the 7-year-old. Are you still here now? Where is the 7-year-old? Has he gone to bed? Are you here now? Okay, I can't see you. Okay, that's okay. So you're here. Good. So, okay.
She's going to retreat.
Going to retreat him? Yeah? Okay, sorry. You're going to get back in. Okay.
Ajahn Brahm.
Yeah. Yes. I got an email from you also said Ajahn Brahm. Stop him. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Doesn't Pure Land teaching trivialize the practice to just chanting Amitabha?
Mm.
And recently when I attended the conference hosted by His Holiness Dalai Lama,
okay,
he specifically said that, you know, people shouldn't be spending too much time praying.
Yeah.
Praying hasn't brought about peace.
Yeah.
In fact, the Muslims pray 5 times a day.
Yeah.
It hasn't brought about peace.
Mm.
His message was, don't spend time. Spend time on cultivation of your mind and heart.
Exactly, yeah.
So,
yeah.
This Pure Land thing, it's almost like making it equal to other religions that, you know, just keep chanting.
Yeah.
Just keep calling the name, whether it's...
Yeah. It really depends how people practice the Pure Land, and I think I've heard people practice it in different ways. Some people might use the chanting as a way of meditation, perhaps, and get somewhere deeper. They might also do a lot of good actions beside that. So it really depends how you practice it. But I think you're right. Some people just do the chanting, and they're happy with that. And of course, it's not going to get you anywhere. Just like in Theravada Buddhism, you have people praying to the Buddha. They actually literally pray to the Buddha as if the Buddha is a god. Same kind of problem. One of the things I really respect about the Dalai Lama is the fact that he doesn't actually go into these kind of more later teachings of Buddhism. He actually goes back to the basics, basically. I really respect that, because he is essentially a Tibetan Buddhist. It would have been natural for him to focus on the Tibetan teachings, but actually he focuses very much on the common core of Buddhist practice. Watching a breath, doing metta, living a good life. And I find that it's actually very, very nice to hear that from a Mahayana teacher. So, yeah, I agree with you there. Okay, are you ready? This is your question, right? So this is your question. So this is a really nice question. So the question is, why do zombies... he disappeared. Okay, that's okay. You can tell him later on what the answer is. Is that a good idea? Yeah?
Are you recording? Do you have your mobile phone?
Yeah. Okay, so... Okay. So the question is, why do zombies exist? I don't want them to exist. This is the question. So why do zombies exist? Well... Are you sure that zombies exist? Maybe they don't exist, right? Maybe it's just some kind of illusion of the mind. Zombies are these things made up by the mind, made up by the movies, right? And the zombies are these things walking around, scary kind of monsters. This is what zombies are all like. And imagine if zombies actually did exist, wouldn't they really be scary? It's just like people from Buddhist countries are often afraid of ghosts, right? But how scary are ghosts? Ghosts are probably not scary at all. They live in this lower realm of suffering. There's nothing they can really do to you, right? I live in the forest in Serpentine by myself all the time. I've never seen a ghost. I'm not even remotely scared of ghosts. They're probably far more scared of me, right? And I see this strange monk wandering around. So often we are scared of things that we shouldn't be scared of, because these beings are not actually dangerous. Of course, if you see a movie, ghosts are scary, because otherwise the movie wouldn't work, right? That's why the ghosts are scary. But in reality, if you see a ghost, the reason why you see a ghost is because the ghost is coming to you to get something from you. The ghosts want you to be kind to it, want you to give it some metta, want to do something on its behalf, transfer some merit or something like that. That is what the ghost does. And if you see a zombie, very likely the zombie is just some kind of ghost, right? That's what they look like to me here. They're not actually dangerous at all. It's only in the movies that these things are dangerous. So forget about those silly movies. Those movies are just stupid. And the reality is, if a zombie comes, have metta towards it. Imagine having to walk around this all the time, right? Whoa! So much dukkha to have to do that. So have metta for the poor zombie who has to walk around like that all the time. And then when you have metta for the beings, then they can be happy, you can be happy, everyone can be happy. That is what it's all about. So. Okay, anyway, so that is the zombies. And we sorted the zombies out. So I've gone a bit over time. So just have a nice evening and a nice night. And I will see you again tomorrow morning here. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha and the Sangha.
Zombie walking meditation. I think I will have to be tomorrow night.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's the last day for some of the people who are.
Oh, okay. So zombie walking
So is there some relation to that?
It's possible that was kind of the that may have been